And so we really got to know each other from there in short order, started hanging out, talking on the phone. Bino talked me down from a couple of ledges. There were a couple times within the program that there were a couple coup d'etats almost orchestrated on me by the regular callers. They would get mad at me over things, and Bino was always my consigliere, would be there for me. How did we come to get involved together? How did you end up on the radio? Do you remember your first time?
Well, Tony, you...
And I apologize. I should remember a lot of this, but it's all a haze to me.
You put me on the radio several times when I would show up at remotes for whatever reason, bless your heart. But, I mean, for short segments. And then Jeff Brock started working for you or with you at...
Team Sports Radio. That's exactly right.
Yep. But then you moved to Horn Radio.
That's exactly right. It's called Getting Fired.
And you gave Jeff your Saturday show. Jeff started doing your Saturday show. And he was going to bring in regular callers on a rotating basis to do the Saturday show. Phil did it week one. I did it week two. Then, for whatever reason, Jeff and I just started doing the Saturday show every week. And Phil was doing the Friday show with you. So that's when I really got involved with regular hosting. And then, you know, you always gave me opportunities as well on certain days. And then I, when things went sour with the operating engineers, I came to you. And I said, Tony, I am going to make a career change, and I've got a couple of years here where I can, if you need some help, where I can work with you full time and see if it's something that I can make a living at or something that I would like to do. And you gave me that opportunity. And so, you know, that's when you and I we've been regular.
Yeah.
I worked for 2 years, and I was such an atrocious salesman. My wife had retired by that time, and you know, I just my sales ability was just so you were so good to me, and I was dragging things down here financially. So I decided I'd go back to the plant to finish up my working life. So, but that was it was around that, and I've got that written down somewhere. I don't remember the year that we started Calhoun Saturday Conversation, but between that and you giving me opportunities, that's when I kind of got comfortable with this.
Yeah,
show.
It was like 2001, 2002.
Yeah, I think it was around 2000. I believe 2002 is right, because I went back to play softball. I thought I was going to quit, and I went back to play softball, and Phil moved from Fridays to Saturdays, and then when I came back, we started that three-man thing that I never thought there was any way in the world would work, and it wound up being pretty good.
You guys were terrific. There was tremendous chemistry among you three. Did you realize early on, hey, we're doing something pretty special here?
Like I told you, when I first came back, I thought, gosh, I'm going to be in the way here. I don't think you can do this with three people. But Tony, for whatever reason, it just worked. What you gave us that up, there's no one else in your profession that would have let three Shade Tree fans that were kind of out there, to be quite honest, do a show under your flag. Thank you for doing that. I'm not sure I would have done it if I was in your place, but for whatever reason, it was a Saturday. It was fans talking to people that they had grown up listening talk to you on the air. It was fans to fans. It was Saturday. Everybody was off. It was early in the morning. It was game day. It just worked.
It was so fun. Those were such fun days. Tennessee was so good back then. There were a couple of highlights in that deal, and I'm going to ask you about them. One of them, and I'm not sure if it's a highlight or a low light, because one of the things that happens, see, invariably people say, well, I'm going to get into this because I love sports. And my reply is, if you feel called to do this because you love sports, don't do this. Because you're not going to love sports, because you're going to end up working in sports.
Yeah.
And then you get to see how the hot dog's really made, and you get to hear the secrets behind the scenes, and you get to see the people are people, and all these people that you've idolized all these years are people, and they're, you know, and they're flawed, and even Peyton Manning sins, I hate to tell you. So with that in mind, what was it like for you as a lifelong fan to get to go to events like, I remember that early in the 2000s, that press gathering that we went to where you guys were doing literally doing your Saturday show from the field in Neyland Stadium from Media Day. When Jeff Brock was snapped upon by Philip Fulmer. What was that whole experience like for you being a fan and then seeing it up close?
Awful. And I admittedly never felt the same about Philip Fulmer after that day. Brocky and I were not only co-hosts, we were really good friends. I thought he asked a legitimate question. Maybe the setting could have been different, but it was, you know, it was the time of the alleged rape and the meeting at Shoney's and all that kind of stuff. And Jeff asked him about it. I can't remember how he phrased the question, but I didn't think it was disrespectful. And Fulmer just basically told him he was a jerk. Today wasn't the day to be talking about that. Today was the day to be celebrating Tennessee football, and basically kind of bullied around as he did the media. You know, those who were involved with Coach Fulmer knows that that's, you know, he was an offensive lineman. that's what he did. But it was really uncomfortable because I didn't want Coach Fulmer to feel badly toward us. We were, and matter of fact, I told him later, I said, Coach, we're fans of the program. We're not professionals at this. We want you to do well as you want to do well. But we had been asked about that time and time and time again, and Jeff felt like it was a legitimate question. So, you know, I didn't feel good in any way.
Fulmer was pissed.
Yes, he was.
I mean, he snapped, and then he came back, snapped some more.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't feel good about it on any aspect that it had happened, the way that Jeff was treated, which I thought was unfairly. I thought it could have been done differently. I thought Coach Fulmer could have answered, maybe evaded the question, and then after we were off the air, he could have aired his grievance. But anyway, it was as I never wanted that to happen. And that made it hard, Tony. It really did. And you said what you said is exactly right. This is enjoyable, but I don't know how you've done it every day, because I did not enjoy Tennessee sports as much as I had in the past when I was doing it on a daily basis. And I kudos to you for keeping this thing so fresh on a daily basis, because that's really, really, really hard to do.
Well, what I've done is I've completely changed the focus, and here's what I mean. That's why I decided to do this. At some point, it becomes not about the wins and the losses, but it becomes about the experience of being a part of all this. And that's what we're doing here today. We're getting to know each other a little better. People are getting to know you a little better. You're sharing some stories, part of your past. We're committing some of that to a canon that is ongoing, and truly you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, you're going to have some heartbreak, you're going to have some great moments, but really what you have as a fan is you have each other, you have those that are a part of your tribe, and within any tribe or any family, you're going to have the black sheep, the outcast. You're going to have a loud mouth. You're going to have the prankster. You're going to have the really intelligent people. And somehow, as a radio family, we've figured out a way to make it all work. And that's one of the things that you taught me when I was doing it every day with you, because one of the things I learned from you was not to focus so much on the results and how it's made and worry about what people are doing or what people are saying, and just enjoy each other. And that's one of the things that you helped me to see was, think of all the people, and I'm going to ask you this now, think of all the people through what we do that you now know in this community.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Harry Scruggses of the world,
yeah,
and the Jeff Brocks of the world,
no,
and the Phil Coopers of the world, and the Brian Hartmans of the world,
no,
and there's just, you know, and the Mike Chases of the world. And these people really and truly, and I'm not leaving anybody out because there's millions of them. There's some folks that have come in the last couple of years, like the Craig Jenkinses of the world and all these folks. They enrich our lives.
No question.
Tom. Right?
No question. And I've been so blessed. I have a group of lifelong friends that I met in high school. I've got a group of friends from work. I've got a group of friends from my years of playing softball and a group of friends from my years in radio. And there's not a whole lot of crossover in those. It's been a real blessing. I've drawn so much from this. And my, you know, Tony, I always knew that this was more about family. My brothers are my heroes. They always have been. They always will be. And they influenced me in this. But Tennessee football to me wasn't what happened on Saturday. It was sitting on my mother's carport with my brother Ron and my brother Mike and my nephews Andy and Chris and whoever may have been, and the Pies on, whoever may have been there at that time, talking about the game and the games that we've been to together. And that, I always understood that. What you taught me was to, there is, it doesn't have to be so dead serious. There's some entertainment in there. There's some funny stuff in there. There's some, that's what you taught me that I didn't have. My competitive nature just wouldn't let me see a lot of that. But I learned that from you, so I appreciate that.
Bino, thank you, my friend. Thanks for sitting down with us and letting us get to know you better, man. What an honor and a privilege it is to call you a friend. And then also, you're just so unbelievably talented and great with that headset on. I'm telling you, that day my father had was in the process of passing away and we were driving to Pennsylvania, I was listening to that show, and my wife is listening with me, and my kids in the back are like, why are you guys laughing and why are you guys smiling, why are you guys, and truly listening that day, I kind of got why this matters to so many people, because it, listening to you guys when you had Philly with you and Brock and Cinco called in that day, and it was just a family deal, and I was just thinking, you know, I'm getting ready to go home, which is my home, and where you're from is always your home no matter who you are, but I'm listening to my home where my homeboys are doing a show out of my house on this magical thing called an app. And it's just something that we all, yeah, my name's on it, but it's something that we all just share. And there's something cool about that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, Tony. It's the closest thing to a real family that I've ever seen evolve from a radio show. And I appreciate the kind words. I love you. I appreciate your friendship. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do this, because it's been, it's just been joyous. It really has.
Bino Jeff Henderson, ladies and gentlemen. We thank the great Bino Jeff Henderson. Now you know him a little better.
College sports are best because the highs are higher and the lows are lower. Oh, those lows. Those lows are just so low. In Tennessee, we're raised with this truth through our history. You found Vol Scars, the place where we get high off the lows and learn more about our Tennessee Vols. Now let's join our cast of losers for Vol Scars.
Tony Basilio, along with Eric Stinnett and the Vol historian, the great Valdi Hedman, to say thy name, Tom Mattingly, welcoming you to our inaugural voyage of Vol Scars. Vol Scars, as we honor the ones that hurt and the ones, more importantly, that left a mark. And today on Vol Scars, we are going to take you back into history, 1958, the Tennessee Volunteers, and your Chattanooga Mocs battle in Neyland Stadium. And in the words of Johnny Majors, it is a day the living fan will never forget. November 8th of 1958, Tennessee and the Chattanooga Mocs, Shields-Watkins Field. And that, ladies and gentlemen, will be where we will begin today on Vol Scars. Tom Mattingly, I welcome you in. My Vol historian, how are you doing, my friend?
Tony, it's good to be here. I was 10 years old that day at Shields-Watkins Field and remember the scene in early November very well.
10-year-old Tom Mattingly was on hand. And obviously, when we talk about Vol Scars and the ones that leave a mark, Eric, this one's not going to have a good ending.
No, it's not. This was in the pre-David Blackburn days at Chattanooga, right?
Pre-David Blackburn. This is the
David
Blackburn day. We are going to talk about 1958. Before we go to that game itself, NASA in the year 1958, Tom, was founded. The United States launches Explorer 1. The first satellite goes into space. Explorer 1, the first satellite launched by the U.S., which would change sports broadcasting forever.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That was obviously an amazing time. I think George Mooney and Bob Fox still did the broadcast on WATE 620 in Knoxville. And I think they did it by the old phone service where they counted down and wolfed and set up the phone lines to do the broadcast. There was a very small Vol network at the time, and the show went on at 1:45 p.m. for a 2 o'clock kickoff. That's almost unheard of these days. Now the pregame show starts 3 hours before the game.
Yeah, they would have said back then, why are you having such a long pregame show, Eric? 15 minutes. My God, what do we do with the time here?
More time for tailgating, right? Who needs 3 hours of pregame stuff, right? Come on.
There were probably 25,000 people at the game. The games didn't draw that well. 30,000 was an exceptional crowd in a 51,000-seat stadium. George Mooney actually went to the game on a boat in those days because he didn't want to fight the traffic from Sequoia Hills. Had maybe 25 or 30,000 people there. It was early November. It was probably starting to get a chill in the air, and the shadows hit the field early. It was just a different time back then. Tennessee had its bench on the east side of Shields-Watkins Field. Chattanooga was coached by a fellow named Andrew Cecil Scrappy Moore, who was actually a great coach, a former Georgia football player from the early 1900s. Always fought Tennessee tooth and nail for about a half before the superior numbers kicked in, and the scores of some of those games were very deceiving. They might be 31-7, but it might have been 10-7 at the half. And there were times that Chattanooga actually led at the half before the numbers kicked in, and they ran out of players, basically.
So 1958, a year, as Tom keeps wanting to pull me into that game, which is what he's here for. February 6th of 58, the Munich air disaster takes place. British European Airways flight crashed at the Munich airport. 44 people killed right after takeoff, including members of the Manchester United football team on their way home, having qualified for the semifinals in the European Cup.
The aircraft was a twin-engined Elizabethan on charter from BEA. It was returning from Belgrade, where Manchester United had entered the semifinal of the European Cup. It had reached Munich and was just taking off for home in poor weather when the crash came at 3 o'clock. It plunged from about 60 feet, bursting into flames near houses. Rescuers fought to recover people from the blazing fuselage. The firefighters also had to contend with houses set on fire by the plane.
So much stuff going on the year 1958. A young 10-year-old Tom Mattingly, would you have been listening to rock and roll in its formative years in 58?
Oh, yeah, Knoxville. The big rock and roll stations were WNOX and WKGN.
Today, the WKGN entertainers are being kind to Butch McDougal. Butch and a friend will be enjoying a deliciously different meal at Arby's in the Kingston Pike.
And I remember sitting up on Saturday night for the Saturday night countdown to the number one song in the nation. It came on about 11:55 on a Saturday night, and I remember getting in a lot of trouble staying up that late, but you had to know what the number one song was. Rock and roll was big in Knoxville. The radio stations really went after each other promotions-wise in those days, and it was a real competition. I remember Dr. Al Adams on 1340 WKGN and Dave Diamond and a bunch of guys like that. It was live from the studios, and they'd crank up the rock and roll. It was an amazing time to be a kid.
Those were the days, right? I mean, gosh, you had real people doing real radio instead of the canned stuff that you got nationwide now, syndicated all over the place. You can't hardly find local radio anymore. I love listening to a good local station like that.
When a young Tom Mattingly would have walked into Neyland Stadium, the number one song in America was Chantilly Lace by the Big Bopper.
Oh, you sweet thing.
Do I want? Will I want? Oh, baby, you know what I like.
Chantilly lace and a pretty face and a ponytail hanging down. Wiggle in the walk and a giggle in the talk. Make the world go round. Ain't nothing in the world like a big-eyed girl to make me act so funny, make me spend my money, make me feel real loose like a long-necked goose, like a girl.
Oh, baby, that's the one I like.
What's that, baby?
It wasn't too many years later that the Big Bopper went down in the plane crash.
That's right.
Wherever it was,
right.
In Kansas.
That's right. On the day that the music died with Ritchie Valens.
Buddy Holly.
Yep.
That was literally, according to the song, the day the music died,
yep.
At least for one writer. When I was growing up, everybody knew all the groups. You could name all the groups and all the big-time singers, and you could almost sing along with the songs. It was literally a different time.
And you were a kid when rock and roll was literally coming of age, and it's against that backdrop in this November day of 1958 when the Volunteers were taking on Chattanooga. The Vols open the year at Auburn. They lose 13-0. The one televised game of the year in 1958, a game that was on NBC television, isn't like today. I mean, the games back then, you had to follow it on the radio.
It was Lindsey Nelson and Red Grange at Legion Field in Birmingham, Alabama. Tennessee, you knew it was going to be a bad year because Tennessee played 60 minutes of football against Auburn and did not make a first down and had minus 17 or minus something yards total offense.
On NBC television, they did not make a first down.
They did not make a first down. It was a 0-0 game going into the fourth quarter, and Auburn scored 13 points. But you can imagine viewers dropping like crazy as Tennessee didn't make a first down and Auburn couldn't score until the fourth quarter. Lindsey Nelson, being a Tennessee alum that he was, probably had to work overtime to make the game sound exciting.
Eric, the fifth quarter fan reaction back then would have been how long after that game?
Fifth quarter? That would have been brutal. Isn't that so Tennessee that we have the rare televised appearance like that and lay the goose egg? That's right, a season-opening goose egg. We're familiar with those. Gosh, we've seen some bad season openers in recent years, certainly in my lifetime.
How many first downs, Tom, for our Volunteers?
That would be zero, Tony.
What a way to start the year!
I don't think in the nearly 60 years that's elapsed since then, I don't think that's happened since in a major college game. Even the teams that get beat 58-0 or 40-0, make a first down somewhere during the game. But Tennessee was running the single wing, and Auburn had it pretty well defensed, and Tennessee couldn't move.
Classic stuff. October 1, number 11 Mississippi State on the schedule. Place called Crump Stadium in Memphis. The Vols emerge victorious, 13-8 in a thriller. What can you tell me about Crump Stadium besides the attractive name that it held?
It was named after Boss Crump, Edward Hull Crump, the supposed red snapper who was the boss in Memphis. And they named it after him while he was still alive, which is a little bit dangerous. Tennessee would open the season against Mississippi State every other year back then. Crump Stadium was located near downtown on Union Avenue. It seated about 30,000 people. It was probably a little dank and dirty. And the sports writers always voted Crump one of the worst press boxes in the country. And it wasn't until 1965 when Memorial Stadium, Liberty Bowl Memorial Stadium, was built in Memphis that they actually got a press box they could be proud of. Tennessee would take the train to Memphis and might arrive 2 or 3 hours before kickoff, get off the train, go straight to the stadium, play the game, get on the train, and come home. Mississippi State and Tennessee played some very uninteresting games in those years. It was always low scoring, and Mississippi State always kept the game close. And Tennessee, with an end named Murray Armstrong catching the winning touchdown pass, actually somehow pulled out the game, but the details of that game are not discussed very much in the history of Tennessee football.
There's good reason. What if that sounds inviting to you?
I think Crump Stadium, and I thought it might be Helen Crump from the Andy Griffith Show. There might be some redeeming quality there. I was hoping. I was keeping my hopes up, but Tom has crushed them, man.
Classic television, in fact, Tom, while we're talking about Chattanooga, our opponent that day, I learned something rather interesting in looking up Chattanooga. Did you guys realize that a famous television father is a graduate of Chattanooga? I'm talking about none other than the great, bow thy head when you say thy name, Hugh Beaumont is a graduate of Chattanooga by way of the Baylor Academy. Tom, were you aware of that?
No, I've always been a great fan of Hugh Beaumont because he was one of the great TV fathers right up there with Andy Griffith and Ozzie Nelson. In fact, I've been watching Leave It to Beaver recently on television, and I am just amazed about how that show reflected the era of the 1950s and early 1960s when it was on. Beaver is actually my age. Beaver is 68 years old, just like I am, Jerry Mathers. I was just impressed. It was like reliving your life to see Beaver go through some of the things he did on that show and how Ward Cleaver, Hugh Beaumont, was able to get him through his preteen and teen years without incident.
Other alums from Chattanooga, B.J. Coleman, Aaron Grant, Spider Johnson, Chris Jones, Joe Kopcha, Derek Lott, Travis McNeil, the great T.O., Terrell Owens, is a Chattanooga grad, Chris Sanders, Turdell Sands, Buster Skrine.
You had no problem with Turdell, Tony. I mean, come on.
Paul Squibb. And, of course, Davis Tall of Bearden. Tom, any of those names ring a bell outside of Davis Tall and one Terrell Owens?
I remember Turdell Middleton played here in the, what, the 80s or the 90s?
Yeah, Turdell Middleton. But this is Turdell Sands.
Turdell Sands, do not know who he is.
Turdell Sands was a American football defensive tackle. How do I know? This thing we call Wikipedia. Drafted by the Kansas City Chiefs in the 7th round of the 2001 draft. Before we go into Shields-Watkins Field that day, as Tom Mattingly's already set the scene for you, and we're back here in early November of 1958. Here are some of the hit songs, Tom, from that year as music is changing before our very eyes. Poor Little Fool from Ricky Nelson in early August was a number one single in America. Dwayne Eddy's Rebel Rouser, Yakety Yak from the Coasters, Peggy Lee's Fever, which is a song that I absolutely love. In fact, let's listen to a little Fever with Peggy Lee.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care.
When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard. And then there is, Tom, I'm sure a song you loved, Are You Really Mine by Jimmy Rogers. Rockin' Robin from Bobby Day. It's All in the Game from Tommy Edwards. Tears on My Pillow, Little Anthony and the Imperials. Do any of these, Tom, bring you back?
They certainly do. Rockin' Robin, that was a big song.
But the day that this game was played, we've already established the number one song in America, Chantilly Lace from the Big Bopper, was number one in America when Chattanooga comes to town against our Volunteers in 1958. The Vols were off to a struggling start. They're 1-1 on the year. We pick it up on October the 11th. The Vols go to Georgia Tech. They're at Grant Field in Atlanta, and they get beat 21-7.
Georgia Tech was pretty good back then, and Tennessee wasn't. Tennessee was offensively challenged that whole year. I think in 10 games they scored 77 points. And Georgia Tech pretty much had Tennessee's number that day. Grant Field was not full. Tennessee fans didn't follow the team on the road as they do now. Bobby Dodd got his big game against Bowden Wyatt. They were both products of General Neyland. Bobby Dodd from the late 20s and early 30s, and Bowden Wyatt from the late 30s. And when these Tennessee coaches got together, it was pretty dang competitive. I won't say they didn't like each other, but they wanted to beat each other pretty bad. And Bowden Wyatt and Bobby Dodd had some classic games. It was just 2 years before that Tennessee had won down there 6-0 on the way to an undefeated regular season. It was exciting back then because the game could turn on any play. Tennessee had those two big plays in the 56th game, John Majors to Buddy Cruz, and Tommy Bronson scores a touchdown that wins the game. But Bill Johnson said it was one of the most tense games that they ever played because Georgia Tech could score on any play, and every play meant something. It was a different game, but you watch the film, and it's still football.
We've already established that rock and roll's coming of age. A young Tom Mattingly is in the stands at this game in Chattanooga that we're about to get to with the Vols as we do Vol Scars, and we honor the ones that hurt and the ones that leave a mark. We talked about rock and roll. We talked about the first satellite shot into the sky. We talked about the formation of NASA. How about this? The microchip, co-invented by Jack Kilby of Texas Instruments and Robert Noyce of Fairchild Semiconductors, later developed and marketed in the U.S. by Intel. Where are we today without the microchip? Are we even having this conversation? Fashion and dress. Would we have seen guys dressing up back then, some of the clips that we saw? What were some of the fashion and dress that you remember about that time period?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the pictures from the old-time games, you see mostly men in suits and hats and precious few women at the game.
Those were the days.
The men came in suits and ties. It looked like a church audience. What women that came in their Sunday best, and you didn't see people in orange shirts. You didn't see people with caps on. You didn't see people with sweaters that said Tennessee across the front. You saw men in shirts and ties.
You saw men.
Some people...
There you go.
Don't believe that. You have to show them the picture, man, that the crowds look so different back in those days.
Tom, the bottom line is you saw men when you walked into Neyland Stadium. They didn't always behave either back in those days. And that's where we pick it up. It is November the 8th, 1958. Chattanooga comes to town. The Volunteers have started the season off with, count them, 1, 2, 3, 4 losses against 2 wins. It is an overcast day on November 8th in Shields-Watkins Field. Tom Mattingly, take me back. What do you remember about the day?
When Chattanooga came to town, as I said, the games were always close for a half before Tennessee finally pulled away. And Tennessee had won 24 straight games against Chattanooga. 24 straight games. And I'm sure me being one, the fans walked into the stadium expecting that Tennessee would win, just like they had the previous 24 times. Chattanooga pretty much took it to Tennessee. Tennessee had no offense. A single wing couldn't score that year. And Chattanooga scored once in the second quarter and once in the fourth quarter, led pillar to post, and with a maybe a minute or two to go in the game, they were ahead 14-0. A pass from Gene Etter to Don Stevens, and I'm sure the place just went nuts that Tennessee had actually scored on Chattanooga. And I'm sure there were a lot of irked people that had Tennessee minus 10 on their parlay card or whatever. And the game ended and one heck of a riot broke out.
Tell us about the riot. This is what Vol Scars is all about.
It was a riot. The Chattanooga fans tried to take down, I think, the north goalpost because that's where their seats were. And they tried to tear down the north goalpost, and Tennessee fans tried to stop them. And there were fist fights on the field, and the fans were really getting after each other. I think they got the north post down. Then they went to the south post in front of where their dressing room was and tried to get those goalposts. And the powers that be in Tennessee turned on the water hoses.
This was early. Turned on the water hose. Right?
They turned on the water hoses, and it wasn't warm water. And Mike Stratton, who played on that team, played later for the Buffalo Bills, said while these fights were going on, they turned on the water, and Tennessee fans pulled out their pocket knives and tried to cut the hose to stop the flow of water while all these fights were going on. The fight went on for 10 or 15 minutes after the game before they finally got everything broken up. And the Chattanooga people claimed police brutality against the Knoxville police for trying to break up the fight. A guy named Bookie Turner, a Chattanooga politician, was the leader in that regard. And they finally got the fight broken up, and it's one of the most memorable I can still see it in the mind's eye. They're down there slugging it out, and people are hacking at the water hoses. The Chattanooga people are ecstatic. The Tennessee people are irked.
You're telling me they pulled knives out of their pockets?
Pocket knives.
How did they get them into the stadium with all the security?
You could walk into the stadium with an Uzi back then, and they really wouldn't have said anything. The only thing they really looked for were bottles of whiskey. They really didn't enforce that much. This was 1958, and people carried pocket knives and probably guns. And
what in the world?
Hey, Tony, remember, we're talking about men with hats. Now, hats, I love hats. With me and my head, the hair I'm losing, I like that era a lot. Give me a hat any day.
But this was not only hats. This was coats and ties.
And these are men out there in coats and ties. Fighting.
They're out there slugging it
fighting.
Out. They're slugging it
going
out.
Going after the goalpost.
Yeah.
In full dress.
Chattanooga hadn't beaten Tennessee since 1910. That was 48 years before, and they'd played 24 times and lost 24 times. So this was a time to get some redemption. The Tennessee fans were irked at losing, obviously. That made the team 2-5 and cast a real pall on whether Bowden Wyatt might make it or not as head coach, and he did until 1962. It was cold. It was overcast, it was damp, but it didn't seem to keep the people from, shall we say, expressing their opinions on the field. And I'm sure at church the next day or at Rotary or whatever, the fans were discussing what was wrong with the program. There were no call-in shows in those days. They had a show called Hold That Line, but you couldn't hear the person on the phone. You could only hear the talent at the radio station.
Sounds like my remote equipment.
It was definitely primitive by your standards, even by your standards in those days.
It's a shot.
It was definitely primitive. People would send letters, and they would call the athletic department. They would discuss it at Rotary, at the quarterback club.
An upset for the ages.
It was an upset for the ages.
And Chattanooga comes to Knoxville. They defeat the Volunteers. It's a game that people to this day talk about. And, Tom, I'm going to ask you, as I remind the listener that you're listening to Vol Scars, as part of the events that went on in our world back then, Toyota and Datsun cars were actually sold in the U.S. for the first time back in 1958. Nikita Khrushchev became the premier of the Soviet Union. No word yet about Nikita Koloff and what he was doing at that point in time. 14-year-old Bobby Fischer won the United States Chess Championship. But back to the day, Chattanooga emerges victorious. I had a local tell me that as a young child, he witnessed this. He said that a cop car, a police officer automobile, to be specific, was thrown or pushed into the Tennessee River post-game. Have you ever heard that story?
I haven't heard that story, but I don't doubt it.
He said the fans were in such an uproar outside the stadium after that game that several mobilized on a police car after they had the hoses on and they got people out of Neyland Stadium that they went to an unmanned police car and threw that damn thing into the river.
It wouldn't surprise me because Tennessee fans were mad, Chattanooga fans were happy, and that's a bad combination when those two things happen. It was just one of those times where everything boiled over all at once. And Tennessee was not used to losing to Chattanooga. And when you think about it, they weren't used to losing. That was their fifth loss of 1958. And there were very few times that Tennessee lost five games over a three-year period.
Could you picture, and I want you to put yourself there, what would you pay to go to a game that ends with men in suits and ties from both sides getting water hoses turned on them to get them off of goalposts, to get them out of warring? They in turn pull knives from their pockets and go over and start stabbing the hoses. Even though the game itself was a dud, what would it mean to be at a game like that?
I'm looking at the 58 season. They had a shutout to Auburn. They got shut out at home by Florida State, a girls' school. And then to suffer this to Chattanooga, yeah, I bet people were ready to rumble. Wow.
That's a good point he brings in, Tom, brings up. The fans were in a fighting mood, and they probably thought that day, a la my days on campus, I remember the loss to Washington State when Tennessee in 88, taking their lumps that year. We kept looking at the Washington State game and going, well, at least we'll win that one. And I'm sure that was probably the mindset of the Tennessee fan. Well, we'll snap our two-game losing streak here, and we'll walk out of here with a 3-2 record. Or a 3-3 record at least. No, you walk out of there 2-4, Tom, and they were ready to fight.
Well, they were, and the interesting thing was next week, number 7 Ole Miss comes to town on their way to the Cotton Bowl, and Tennessee somehow wins. They score 18 points, which was unheard of that year, and beat Ole Miss 18-16 when the Ole Miss kicker misses a chip shot field goal at the south end. And I'm sure Ole Miss, when they got close enough and that Bob Kiat was kicking the field goal, at the field goal, that, well, we survived Knoxville, and he missed the field goal. Tennessee wins 18-16. Gene Etter runs out of his shoe on a 76-yard touchdown pass. He was hit at around the ankles at the 50-yard line and comes out of his shoe and scores a touchdown. I had a friend tell me once that immediately after he scored that touchdown, he had to go to the dressing room because he felt a call of nature on his way to the end zone. He scored the touchdown, then immediately went to the Tennessee dressing room on the east side.
Ran right into the tunnel,
went in, did his business, changed his pants, and came back out a series later.
Glad nobody gave him a real tackle on the way in, because that would not have been pretty if he'd have been tackled and, say, given a kidney shot. Let's review the standings from that year as Tennessee went on and finished 4-6 on the year, 4-3 in Southeastern Conference play. LSU finishes 11-0 on the year. Auburn finishes 9-0-1. LSU wins the league, 6 wins, 0 losses, 0 ties. Auburn with 6 wins, 0 losses, and 1 tie. Tom, I'm noticing a discrepancy in the number of SEC games played in 19 and 58. Why are some playing 7 and some are playing 6? What's going on here?
It was just a matter of how they scheduled. Tennessee hadn't played Georgia since 1938.
What the hell?
Excuse me, he hadn't played Georgia since 37. They didn't play Georgia. They rarely played LSU. They rarely played Tulane. Georgia Tech was still in the conference back then. One of the things that made Bear Bryant a genius, and I'll say this tangentially, is that while everybody else was playing 6 conference games back in those days, Bear Bryant always played 7 to give him the extra game in case he lost a game. He could still win the conference on percentage. Tennessee played Auburn, just started playing Auburn again 2 years before. Didn't play Georgia, didn't play Tulane, didn't play LSU, didn't play Florida, if you can believe that. But they tried to play everybody else in the conference. The 58 team, as bad as it was, still managed to beat Bear Bryant's first Alabama team in mid-October at Shields-Watkins Field, 14-7.
How crazy is that? On a year when you lose to Chattanooga, you still manage to defeat Alabama, and you still have a couple players drafted into the NFL draft. Carl Smith, who was a back on that team, a ninth-round pick of the Detroit Lions, pick number 101 overall. And get this one, guys. LeBron Shields, a tackle on that team, a 22nd-round draft pick of your Detroit Lions, pick number 256 overall in the NFL draft, LeBron Shields.
Actually, LeBron Shields is better known as Cooter. His nickname was Cooter.
That's the first Cooter that we sent to Detroit then, right? Jim Bob Cooter was only the second Cooter that was sent to Detroit.
Right. But he was known as Cooter.
Gotcha.
We didn't have a lot of SEC picks in those days. Had precious few All-Americas, and that's probably why we were 4-6 or 5-5. As we were in those days, and we clung grimly to the single wing up until 1962 when Bowden Wyatt was finally let go. Jim McDonald came in and sort of hinted that they might play the T formation, but they really didn't go to the T formation for real until 1964 with Douglas Adair Dickey and Hal Wantlin and Art Galifa and David Leek.
And that is the rest of the story, because the Volunteers in 1958 finished the year 4-6. They finished 4-3 in the SEC. Bowden Wyatt finishes his fourth year, and now you know the one game that year that left a mark, the Volscar of 1958. Chattanooga comes to Knoxville and wins 14-6 over the Volunteers in a game that ends in a brawl for it all. Tom Mattingly, anything else you want to say about the 58 Chattanooga game that happened on November the 8th, 1958?
It's just one of those games that leaves a mark. You talk about the great upsets in Tennessee football history, the 46 Wake Forest game, the 75 North Texas game, the 80 Virginia game, and numerous others, the 96 Memphis game. I still want to say Memphis State.
It's okay. You can say it.
This one left a mark on me 58 years later. I can still close my eyes and see the scene on the field after the game. And it was one of the most – I'd never seen a public fight before. I was 10 years old and never saw people fight in public. And here these guys are down there getting hosed down, slugging it out.
One goal post goes down.
The other one.
And there, let's go get the other one.
Go get the other one. And it just really fascinated me at my youthful days, because I haven't seen anything like that since.
I'm scratching my head trying to figure out how Bowden Wyatt hung on for, what, 4 or 5 more years after losing like that. I mean, you go through a season where you score 77 points and that's it, and a riot on the field, you lose to UT Chattanooga, and you still keeping your job? Goodness.
Bowden was one of their own. General Nealon was still the
athletic director.
They still were clinging grimly to the single wing. And Bowden Wyatt started off the next year. He started off 1959 5-1-1 before the wheels fell off. He was just good enough not to get fired in those days.
Wow.
Kind of sounds familiar. As we look back. Yeah, as we look back to look ahead, it's what we do here on Volscars. By the way, Tom, you had mentioned some of the games that through your past, that just off the top of your head, that have left a mark. That 80 Virginia game, that's one we're going to tackle in this series. The 96 game with Memphis is one we're going to tackle in this series. What were the couple other ones you had talked about?
There was the 75 North Texas.
We're going to tackle that in this series.
That was an interesting day. Tennessee had more than 500 yards rushing, 500 yards total offense, and lost the game and scored 14 points.
In our next Volscar, we're going to jump ahead to 1973. The Georgia Bulldogs are in Neyland Stadium. The world is a-changing. But once again, I remind you, on November the 8th, 1958, the final score, Chattanooga 14, your Tennessee Volunteers 6. For Eric Stinnett, the great Tom Mattingly, our Vol historian, this is Tony Basilio saying, Vol scars, they leave a mark.
We hope you enjoyed today's edition of Vol Scars, commercial-free. And if you did, you're probably a masochist. Please consider leaving us a tip today if you enjoyed the show and share it with others. Help us keep Radio Free Tennessee alive. Thanks for helping us get the word out as we savor our history in Rocky Top. Have an idea for a Vol Scar? Shoot us an email, commonfan@gmail.com. Oh, and one final thing. Go Vols!